You're listening to Seminary Dropout, and I'm your host, Shane Blackshear. In cooperation with MissioAlliance.org, straight from my house in Austin, Texas to yours, interviews with leading Christian authors, leaders, and thinkers, because good theology should be for everyone. This is Seminary Dropout. Let's go!
Hey there, friends. This is part two of a two-part series on voting. And I want to give kind of the same disclosure that I gave last episode, which is you may not agree with everything that's said in this podcast, and that's okay. What I want to ask is that you don't dismiss the entire thing because of those one or two few things. Sit with it, pray about it, think on it. Okay, here it is.
My guest is Nikesha Elena Alexis. Nikesha is an independent scholar with wide-ranging interests related to human and other animal liberation. She orients her life toward undoing oppression through her vegan practice, teaching and writing, and various types of organizing in her community. She's co-founder and co-organizer of Jesus Radicals, an online space for exploring faith, politics, and the particular connections between anarchism and Christianity, and host of its Iconocast Canvas podcast. She works at Anabaptist Mennonite Biblical Seminary on the communication team and as an intercultural competence in undoing racism coordinator. Nikesha, thanks so much for joining me on the show today.
Oh, thanks for the invitation. I'm glad for it.
So you are a part of the Anabaptist tradition, and I'm curious about how you became a part of that. Was it a family thing? Is that a faith that you grew up in?
Actually, no, I'm originally from Trinidad, and I grew up mostly in the Roman Catholic tradition. And coming to the U.S., continued that for a while, and then was part of a non-denominational Black church, that my uncle-in-law was pastor of, and was actually attending a, liberal Catholic Church, which is not quite underneath the Catholic Church. It's still a structure that I don't really understand. When I met a Mennonite, and after I established that it was not a cult, I had not heard of Mennonites before. I remember I checked with my uncle. I was like, so I met this person. They say they're part of a thing called the Mennonites. Like, is that okay? And he's like, well, I think they're kind of like the Amish. It should be safe. came into the Mennonite tradition in my 20s in New York City. So, yeah, that it was definitely not what I was raised in. And I consider myself a real Anabaptist because I do believe I was baptized as a child. My mom will have to correct me if that's incorrect. And then was baptized again at the age of 14. So I am truly rebaptized.
Yeah, you are literally an Anabaptist.
I am an Anabaptist. Take that, all ye Yoders.
Oh, what was attractive to you about the Mennonite group?
Well, I think one of the things, so I was active as a student at New York University. I'm trying to think through the timing here. But was active at New York University in some peace work, had grown up in, and went to a high school that had emphasized, where we were doing issues of racism and those kinds of things. So had a fairly unique high school experience and carried that over into college. My degree is in Africana studies. And so interacting with a lot of social justice issues within as a young adult. And for a long time, I think I saw those things as important, but I didn't really have a way necessarily of linking it to my faith. So here I am. I'm Christian, and I'm also interested in issues of social justice, but they seem to be things in parallel rather than things intertwined. And so one of the things that attracted me to Mennonites, and particularly to Manhattan Mennonite Fellowship, which was the first congregation that I interacted with in New York City, which is where I grew up, was 9/11 had happened, and I was already kind of attending that congregation and attending the liberal Catholic church that I was still a part of, so in two traditions. And here was this church that was concerned about peacemaking, and their reaction to that event and to plans to make war immediately following were very distinct and very different from other Christian, other people claiming to be Christian. And so I think one of the things that really kind of hooked me in was, okay, here, this social justice stuff that I'm interested in, these issues of race and class and whatnot, I don't have to look at that as something that is an add-on to my faith. Actually, Jesus perhaps even has something to say that would speak to these issues. So that was certainly, I mean, that's kind of a long way of answering the question, but really seeing in the Mennonite tradition, in that particular congregation, this holding together that our ethics and our faith and our lives, if we're following Jesus, we need to be concerned about these other things. It's not a special sort of tack on that we add. And also in the context of that congregation too, the community life that I witnessed, like New York is a very transient place. Manhattan Mennonite Fellowship had a lot of people that came and went. But the time that I started attending there, the pastor at the time, Arlene Pipkin, she was diagnosed with cancer. And to see this congregation kind of rally around her and her spouse as she struggled with the disease and eventually died was huge. So I would say, yeah, the community life, watching in this sort of place where people come and go, folks really tune into one another and be supportive of one another. And then also this kind of outward facing attention to justice, to peace, especially to resisting war, as crucial. I don't know how many other people can say that they went to anti-war protests with, you know, people from their church. Like we're just all going to get on a bus and go to Washington together. So those were the kinds of things that were very attractive to me.
Hey friends, welcome to part 3 of my talk with Sarah Bessie about the new book Soul Bear, which she contributed to. In Soul Bear, each chapter features a different author, people like Emily P. Freeman, Trillian Newbell, and Holly Girth. You can get Soul Bear for 30% off by going to ivpress.com/dropout. So Sarah, do you have a favorite chapter in the book that's not your own?
Absolutely, I do. I actually have a few that I really, really loved. I mean, every single one of them is incredible for its own, you know, own reason. But well, I think two that in particular jump out at my memory from reading over them is the one by Seth Haynes called Nuance. He writes a short essay about an experience when his youngest son was sick and dealing with people's platitudes almost. You know, like the things that people will tell you when you are sick or when your children are sick, and they mean well, they mean to be saying something encouraging, but the way that you receive that when you are in the midst of suffering and pain can be so different than how they intend it. And I just thought that was something that we haven't really talked about a lot in the church, in particular for people with chronic illness or people who love someone with chronic illness, as they're grappling with, you know, prayer and with comfort and with suffering and pain and all those sorts of things. I mean, it was just a really beautiful and insightful essay. And another one I really liked was, I think Amy Peterson wrote one called about being a teenage heretic. Just kind of that, you know, betwixt and between season in your teenage years when you are emerging from everything that you have been taught and your way to see the world. And then you are, you know, encountering something different and wanting to almost play with it or or explore it, and almost the forbiddenness of it makes it more exciting. But yet she draws these really beautiful parallels between how she was experiencing, she thought she was experiencing, you know, kind of this, you know, agnosticism or whatever else, but still she was just so pursued by the way that she had been brought up and by how she had been taught to understand the world, and even that language never really escaped and left her. And so anyway, it was a really beautiful essay. There's so many different ones in here that are just, you know, diverse and beautiful and hard and brave. And I don't know, I feel like it's almost all of them are topics that we don't talk a lot about in communities of faith, particularly if we're very concerned about, you know, being a shiny, happy Jesus person.
The book is called Soul Bear. Get it for 30% off by going to ivpress.com/dropout. So one of the primary reasons I wanted to talk with you is because I wanted to have a conversation about voting.
Mm-hmm.
We, this time of, well, not this time of year, but this, when we're in the election cycle, the whole country kind of goes crazy, and Christians are often no exception.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of us who grew up in Christianity, especially in an evangelical Protestant church, a lot of us had a church that really married right-wing politics and Christianity
mm-hmm.
in a really unhealthy way. A lot of us, kind of as we got older, we saw how destructive that was, how unbiblical that was in a lot of ways. But it seems like a lot of people's response is just to kind of hand Jesus over to the other side and marry left-wing politics in that way, that same way.
Mm-hmm.
There are very, very few Christians who choose to abstain from voting.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wonder if you could talk about your viewpoint on that and how you got there.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the things to kind of tie your last question to this one, as I was being introduced to the Mennonite expression of Anabaptism, I was also investigating and beginning to adopt as well anarchist politics. So in its most basic understanding, anarchism is about resisting oppression, resisting sources of domination, structures of domination, interpersonal expressions of hierarchical relationships to one another. And so that was another reason too why, and I came at that, I should say, not from reading, you know, some of the classical anarchists up front, but really in sort of seeing and being introduced to Jesus in a different way, beginning to read the Gospels in a different way. Mm-hmm. So that's another part of the foundation that I think it bears naming, because all of those things kind of influence how I've come to the position that I have now, in which I think the first and the last presidential election that I voted in was Al Gore versus George Bush.
Sure.
And I wasn't even like leaning the way that I do politically when I did that. But if there's any election that will sort of tell you a thing about electoral politics, like, oh, I got up early, I did my civic duty, I went out there, I got my vote going, and what? Somebody else? Wait, I don't understand. So yeah, definitely that probably provided some sort of fertilizer, if you will, for where I've ended up now. The first and last kind of local election I voted in was here in Elkhart, Indiana, where I live, where it was a referendum having to do with school buses and providing enough transportation for kids to go to school. So I thought, okay, if there's something that I'm going to vote for, it's not about a personality. There's a real need, and I can go behind that. But I didn't vote for Obama. I am not intending at this point to vote in this current election. And I think it's, you know, and I say this being fully and very conscious of the fact that I am an immigrant, that immigrants struggle for the right to vote. I don't take it lightly that I don't do it from that social location. I'm also a Black woman living in the U.S. So again, I see this as my perspective and not necessarily, something that I demand or expect other people to do or not do, because I understand that it's complicated, particularly for people who embody those positions in society. But for me, there are multiple levels, theological and I think politically, that make it problematic for me. So, you know, do you know, for example, I heard a number tossed around, but do you know how much gets spent, and like how much money people are spending right now in this election cycle?
Oh, I can't imagine. It's got to be like close to $1 billion, probably.
Yeah. Someone said a trillion. I wasn't sure. That is not quotable.
That's entirely, yeah. I mean, as I said the word billions, that was kind of naive. It's probably much, much more than that. I wouldn't doubt it.
Right. And so I think what fascinates me is that we spend in terms of whether it's people, individuals making contributions to a person's campaign or people actually using those funds to campaign, we spend that incredible amount of money to select one person, or if we're looking at the whole scale, multiple people to do things that money could probably do. Right?
Yeah.
So to me, there's a pragmatic side that's like, honestly, this actually doesn't make, it's not logical on one level, right? Like if we have all of these social problems that require funds to address, and all, you know, so much of it is being driven into this, you know, in some ways, what kind of feels like a circus, in order to select someone or someone to deal with the problems that the money could actually do something with. It feels very circular to me.
Yeah. So in other words, you know, we vote on someone because we think that they are going to, say, help alleviate hunger, when fraction of the money that person spent to get elected could eliminate hunger.
Exactly. Yeah. That's odd. That strikes me as a little bit strange. Some of it is fiscal resources, that I've begun to think about more on just that very basic level. The other thing I think that's a little bit more complicated is energy level in terms of interpersonal energy or individual energy or collective energy and where that gets channeled. So, I went to, and I do participate in the sense that, you know, I have gone to city council meetings. I went to the Bernie Sanders rally that they had in South Bend here recently because I'm interested. I'm not voting, I want to be clear, is not about being uninterested and like, oh, well, it's all going to hell anyway, so why pay attention?
Not about nihilism.
Exactly. It's definitely not about that. And I would guess that on some levels, I probably pay attention more than some of our average kind of voting people who watch Fox News or watch CNN and then figure out who they're going to vote for or think that one makes a good president because he looks really cute or, you know, whatever. That's a little bit pejorative. But I think I try to keep up in a way that even sometimes the people who are making these huge decisions don't. So I did go to a Bernie Sanders rally and I listened and I took notes. And part of what I was thinking was like, oh man, there are thousands of people in this building right now. What, dear Lord, might we be able to come together and do, even whether it's in the form of a traditional protest or to actually together address the things that he's speaking about.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think Black Lives Matter is fairly instructive about this, in the sense that, you know, the reason why we are getting, you know, police officers actually going to grand juries, the reason why people are being indicted is not because we all voted for something to happen, but because of the grassroots kind of energy in the streets. And so I think elections in a very serious way that actually prevents our imagination from thinking outside of the box, that actually, I think, limits our capacity to see alternatives. It channels all this energy into a place that is wildly inefficient, and also doesn't actually, on a lot of levels, I think, do what it is we expect it to do. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely.
Are there questions about that? Like, I want to hear your thoughts too.
You've said a lot of things that I want to unpack, but I want you to finish your thought.
Okay,
first.
Sure. I have an essay in a book called Electing Not to Vote. And there are several essays in there. And one of the essays by Andy Alexis Baker, he talks about during the Vietnam War, when the voting age was lowered, and the specific sort of repeated argument that we have to take the energy that is out in the streets right now around this war. We have to find a way to put this within the channels that are normative. Mm. It wasn't just like, hey, we think that 18-year-olds or whoever, they're just so brilliant and we need to have them involved in the process. But it was a deliberate way to take that protest energy and that spirit thinking bigger and of finding ways to resist and to say, we have to get that into a place that is manageable. We have to get it into a place that is normative. We have to get it into a place that's not disruptive. And so in so much as, you know, what happens, let's say what happens when we don't get what we want, the voters, inevitably some folks don't, like what happens in the 4-year period? What do people do? What do most voters do? I mean, what
Complain.
Do you do? Right. And so there is a way in which there's this sort of national fervor and national foment, and everybody's sort of wound up about this, and it matters. I'm not saying that it doesn't matter. But then at the end of it, there's this sort of deflation, and it's kind of like, okay, well, do we still not need, universal healthcare? Are we just going to wait for the next 4 years to try again,
right.
while, you know, people are dying? Do we still not need an end to police brutality? Like, are you going to come out in the street and do and say a thing, or are we just going to wait until the next cycle? So I really do think that elections, they not only take fiscal energy, but they take imaginative energy. They take people power, and displace it from thinking creatively about what are the other things that we need to be doing all the time,
yeah,
to be addressing the issues that are dear to us, that are vital to some of our survival, if you will. I'll stop there so we can do some unpacking.
Okay, that's perfect. So one of the things that you said kind of earlier on was you mentioned the impact of anarchist thinking and philosophy on you. I think that most people who have a peripheral knowledge of anarchism, frankly, mostly associate that with like the 1980s punk scene.
Right.
And maybe violence that went along with that and the kind of youthful naivete that goes along with that. And I think, and I don't pretend to be completely schooled in anarchism, but what I do think is that people often don't understand that there is a Christian tradition of anarchism, of Christian anarchists. And that too, what I love that you said that you didn't come to that way of thinking from reading traditional anarchists, but you came that way by reading the Bible and reading about Jesus. You know, I like to think that Christianity is what it is. We get often get it messed up into something else, but we often find that there are very parallel ways of life to what Jesus espoused and who he was. And it seems like anarchism is one of those things.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and I have to, I do have to give credit to again, to Andy Alexis Baker for some of this, because, well, not for some of it, for introducing me to the readings and those kinds of things that, that would help shape my understanding, and also help me to adopt it as my own, and to expand on it as I've been doing, you know, work around race and animal liberation and all of these sorts of things. So it's always evolving, but Jesus is, I wouldn't make the move of being like, well, Jesus was an anarchist. That would be no, but what we see in the Gospels, when we read the Gospels, not only from a spiritual kind of perspective, which is the way that it often gets read, Jesus is really talking about what my spirit is supposed to do, or, you know, he's only talking about interpersonal relationships. The social location of Jesus is an oppressed person in an empire. And I think even like leftist Christians forget this, because we talk about Jesus often as working on behalf of the poor, or, you know, Jesus was concerned for the widow, or, you know, I think even when we know, like, Jesus is not a white savior, on the left, we still talk about him as if he is. But Jesus wasn't working on behalf of the poor, he was poor. That's a totally different way of understanding what it is he's doing. He's not trying to liberate others only. Jesus is liberating himself, his family. That is part of the concern. And so, you know, Jesus is not just working with the people in the empire, working with the people on the margins. He is on the margins. He is a victim of empire, not only in terms of his living, but certainly in his dying on the cross. And so what Jesus is pretty rebellious. I don't think we allow him to be often in the way that we read the scriptures. And so what you have in Christ is this challenge to religious structures that are themselves oppressive, to those who are sick, to those who are women, to those who don't fit certain kind of norms at that time. And there's a reason, you know, why he undergoes Roman crucifixion. The stuff that he's talking about is not just about stirring up religious norms, but they have social consequences. And so I think the community that the church is called to be, certainly if we see in terms of Acts, it kind of feels a little bit socialist if everybody's sharing everything.
Sure.
You know, right? Like, there are ways in which what we are offered is an upturning of certain social hierarchies, and an invitation into a community in which those hierarchies do not dictate the way in which we live together. They don't limit us from being in right relationship with one another. Jacques Ellul who is a Christian and an anarchist, has done some extensive kind of writing on the temptations of Jesus, on the Gospels, and viewing that through an anarchist kind of lens. So I would encourage people to find his work. We have some of his stuff yet on JesusRadicals.com, which is the website that I help to run. But when you read the Gospels through the lens of the politics of the time, I wouldn't call it anarchist, but it also isn't some of the other structures that we, it's not totalitarian. It's not a new government, if you will, that gets created in terms of the church, what the church is called and expected to be. Mm. So, you know, those are the parts that resonate for me with anarchist politics in terms of what it's trying to do with social relationships. There's certainly dissonance, and anarchism has lots of different flavors. It was through kind of looking at the Gospels in a new way and being invited to look into the Gospels in a new way that opened up this other political possibility for me.
One of the other things that you mentioned was the part about privilege.
Mm-hmm.
You're a woman of color. You're an immigrant. You and I are like on the opposite spectrum of the privilege scale, right?
Right.
And so, you know, for someone like me to say I'm not going to vote, it's fairly, aside from some slight social ostracization,
mm-hmm.
and some good talking to that people would like to give me online, I'm probably going to be okay.
Right.
I'm probably gonna do all right, no matter if my voice is heard at the voting booth or not.
Mm-hmm.
But for someone like you to decide not to vote, it feels like that's a much larger commitment from you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, I think oddly enough, I get some inspiration through the tradition of Black struggle in the U.S. and women's struggle in the U.S. in the sense that, Lord help us, if we had waited until we could vote we're just going to wait until we get our turn so we could tell people to release folks from slavery.
Mm.
Right? Like, oh, okay, we're just going to wait until somebody gives me my turn at the voting booth before I'm recognized as not a second-class citizen as a woman, right? Like,
yeah.
The ways in which people have made progress for their survival in this country has never depended on voting. I mean, maybe that might be too strong. For hundreds of years, voting is not the way in which we have been able to resist and make the changes that we have today. And so I understand that it is stepping outside of a narrative in which, you know, voting, people have died for us to vote. And so, you know, I'll hear things like, it doesn't matter who you vote for, you just need to go out and vote.
Yeah, yeah.
To me, that's really problematic.
Yep, yep.
I mean, that's really problematic. What is it? Is it voting? What is sacred there? I mean, there seems to be underneath that a kind of sacrament, something sacred, that yes, it doesn't yes. matter who I vote for, so long as I show up and I vote. So that, is it more detestable for me as a woman of color to not vote for Donald Trump or to not vote for anybody than it is for me as a woman of color who's interested in liberation to go and vote for Donald Trump, because at least it means I voted. Yeah. You know, I don't think we, I don't think we often, or at least I feel like sometimes that narrative is so trapping. And like, really, to be able to have the integrity to look around and say, none of this, I do not see a way forward with these choices. And I have the responsibility to try and figure out what the way forward is if I'm not going to participate in this system. It's not an invitation to sit around and not deal with white supremacy or not deal with some of these, you know, police brutality, or not deal with these, with the issues that are, or hunger or whatever that are pressing on us. It's not an invitation to do that. But if you can't, with integrity, look at the choices that are offered to you, and yet you have this sort of narrative, it's like it is sacred that you vote regardless.
Yes.
To me, that's really problematic. It was so interesting being at the Bernie Sanders rally because he wrapped up his speech, which was a very rousing speech. But he wrapped up his speech with some examples from history of movements for change. And, you know, he was like, you know, 100 years ago, children were working in factories, laborers and workers rose up and said, we're not having this anymore, you know. And now, look, we have, you know, at least some of us have 8-hour days or whatever without having children in factories anymore, you know.
Right.
However many hundred years ago, people rose up, however many decades ago. And what was so interesting about all of the examples that he gave were that they were examples that occurred outside of the voting system.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's like, yeah, women's liberation, right? So there also is this very strange, and I noticed it, and it was sort of like the wrap-up was like, so we are the revolution and go out and vote for me on Tuesday.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought, or it's like, we are the revolution and there are however many thousands of people here in this building, and help us, Lord, what might we be able to do together about the things that we are all saying we're here in the building and agreeing about?
Yeah.
So, you know, I definitely understand the resistance, but it is also within our tradition, whether it, you know, and again, I'm originally from Trinidad, but immigrants have also struggled in this country too to be recognized,
yeah.
To be treated as full human beings, and continue to do so. Undocumented people right now, with our Latino and Latina brothers and sisters right now, are struggling all over the country, and they don't have the right to vote. And so, you know, again, it kind of ties back to what I was saying about our imagination and the way in which stories kind of shape us. Like, not everybody has been able to vote, and change has been made outside of that process. And not small change, but serious, significant changes. And so, you know, I still continue to see myself within the Black tradition that I have been adopted into and have adopted within the U.S., within immigrant struggles that have happened in the past and are happening now, and within women's struggles, that not voting does not put me outside of those things. And I also, I mean, I try not to argue with people who see it that way, but that's my position, that, you know, that has not been our go-to.
Right.
It has only been very recently that has even been an option in a serious way. And so help us if we think that that's the only way or the primary way or the main way by which we do things to better our lives. Like, that is not true. It's not historically true.
So inevitably, anytime I try to broach the subject online, someone will bring up the Edmund Burke quote that says the only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And to your point, I think we are so brainwashed to believe that going to the voting booth for a few hours every 4 years is like a huge contribution to the world.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's what doing something is.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's very, you kind of touched on this. I think it's very idolatrous for a Christian to go down that path. You mentioned it, just the idea of voting being so sacred, but that's not, you know, Jesus didn't command anything about voting.
Mm-hmm.
And so for Christians to hold it in such a high place, it seems like such an idol for us.
Well, I mean, I think one of the things that Elul talks about, I think in his book, Anarchism and Christianity, it's called, is the temptations of Jesus. And, you know, again, when you're reading things just from a strictly spiritual, it is a spiritual thing. I don't want to discount that. But thinking through it also socially and politically, what's happening there? Because the spirit and is not separate from the body. There's all of that is happening in these encounters. And so some people might have heard this already, but reflecting on the temptation around the kingdom, that every temptation is a way for Jesus to take a shortcut around doing the hard work. And the painful work that his agitation is going to take him towards. And so, you know, Satan is there and says, here are all the kingdoms of the world. I will give that to you. All you have to do is worship me. And, you know, these are mine to give. And so I think that there is a spiritual component that we can't, leave out when we're talking about these structures, whether it's government structures or even in our church structures as well, right? Like we have to be paying attention to the spirits that are moving around us and working through the things that we create with our hands. And so, you know, yeah, there is a way in which, I guess you could say, like, you know, where do we think God is? God only moving there? and what is our responsibility in between the time of the election? You know, to go back to the point that I was raising, it's like, okay, we all go. And then what happens in between the 4 years for most voters? I'm not saying all voters, because, you know, certainly there are people who are involved in struggle and resistance movements that are voting, and they're holding picket lines. They're voting. And they're liberating animals from animal labs. They're voting and they do it, right? There are people who are able to do both of these things. But for most of the people who are voting, what are you doing in the in-between time? Like, I feel like for me, in some ways, because I have opted out of voting, I'm always looking for other ways to be involved. My work is around educating around issues of anti-oppression. Like, my spare time is hanging out with people who are doing those kinds of things as well, right? There's a way in which I am shaping my life so that in some way or another, I'm either encountering the issues that I need to be attentive to, or I'm trying to find ways to address those issues, or I'm helping to train people so that they can address those issues, et cetera, right? It's not outside of my scope of how I interact and move in the world.
Right.
And can most voters who are Christians, I don't know, say that. I mean, I think at the very least, I mean, I'm not trying to put myself above anybody, but at the very least, that needs to be a point of self-reflection. I think that this election is so, so very interesting because of Donald Trump. Right? Like, wow, you know, what a zoo. Well, really, well, maybe not a zoo. That's not vegan friendly.
You know, circus. Like, no, that's a lot.
Yeah,
no, that's not
vegan friendly either. You know, what a clusterfuck, really. That's probably appropriate.
Yeah.
So here is someone who is inciting, stirring up, bringing to light the very deep entrenched sexist, patriarchal, racist, white supremacist, xenophobic, right? It's all coming to bear in a public way, in a way in which it has. Like, this is not new, right? Like,
yeah.
George Zimmerman, all the we have had many instances, very public, very painful instances of this kind of overtone and undertone in our nation's kind of life together. And in some ways, it's kind of culminating in this election cycle in the presentation of Donald Trump. And so I have wondered to myself, okay, let's say that he wins. Is everybody just going to take their ball and go home?
Yeah.
Right?
Just
like
go underground for the next 4 years.
Right. And the other thing that I think about elections, too, is like for him to get to the place that he has been, many things have not been done. Right. Like this is the part where the fire is burning the house down already.
Mm-hmm.
So what needed to be done? How can we learn from this to get to the place where we get at where the match is being struck? Right. Like,
yeah.
So, you know, I often think about when I hear liberals complaining about Donald Trump and, you know, we can't believe that he's gotten here or whatever. I mean, I'll tell you, my phrase is like, well, talk to your cousins, find your people.
Yeah.
Right. Like he is a sign that there have been some very deep divisions in the white community in which people are not speaking to one another, and that there are class implications for that too, right? Like we're all highly educated. All those people are rednecks. We don't want to deal with them. They're so crazy. Who else is going to talk to them?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, what's going to happen that's what I'm interested in. If he becomes the president, do we all take our ball and go home and just kind of suffer through things? Or are the people who are really passionate about these issues enough to vote? Can you step out and do some other things?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it might require it. And is your imagination going to be big enough for you to see yourself doing some other things? Getting involved in other ways? You know, again, these are questions, I think, for self-reflection. People who are listening might be able to say, well, of course, duh. And that's great. I'm glad if those are the responses that people are able to come to. But again, because I think because I don't vote, I feel like I pay very close attention. I still try to find ways to be listening to what is being said, to be thinking strategically about what certain outcomes mean. It's not an invitation to just sit around and be like, well, again, you know, it's all going to hell anyway. We're just waiting for the system to collapse. And so I'm going to take like a non-resistance Amish position and kind of hang out and wait to see it fall.
Yeah.
That's definitely not what I'm advocating.
Well, I've had the thought recently, and I think this is a lot of what you've been saying, that if just tomorrow Christians woke up and decided to take Jesus seriously and act like Christians, the vast majority of our problems in contemporary society would go away overnight.
Mm-hmm.
If just Christians, like before we even convert anybody else, just those who claim to follow Christ, if they really did it tomorrow, almost all of our problems go away. I think
right.
That's kind of what you're talking about, of those, you know, all those people, if they use their energy for something else besides getting one person elected, you know, if we focus our energy on, you know, other avenues of bringing redemption and reconciliation to the world, it will have that. It will have redemption and reconciliation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I think again, that goes to the way that we do theology. It goes to the way that we read our Bibles. It goes to the way, you know, I think we take Jesus seriously. We just take Jesus seriously in different ways.
Yeah.
Right.
Well,
like, you know, so some of it would, the first thing would be, is like, trying to figure out, not just do we take Jesus seriously, because, you know, again, some people, they feel like they have that part down, but do we understand who Jesus was?
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I mean, I think the first thing is if Christians woke up tomorrow and like asked, really tried to understand who Jesus was, the social location of Jesus, what Jesus was about, who Jesus was around, who Jesus is himself, what Jesus is calling us to now, because we believe in the Christian tradition that Jesus is not dead, that God is still acting in and through us, right? Like we have a narrative, we have a belief that Jesus is still speaking. And so how do we understand who this was and is? And what we're being, and then we would know what we were being called to. But I also think too, really, like the system would get really freaked out if everybody decided not to vote.
Yeah.
I mean, what would we do? Could we imagine, like, would everything stop? And I mean, I have to say, right, like on the one hand, voting, it's not noteworthy. That's too many double nods. It is noteworthy that, right, that there can be changes of leadership and civil war doesn't break out. Yeah, I mean, again, yeah. I'm also aware of like our international brothers and sisters for whom that is not the case. Like, again, I don't want to be taking things light. These things make a difference. But I think we have to ask ourselves, is it making the difference that we want? Mm. Voting does something. I am not of the mindset that it's like it's not doing anything at all. Candidates, there are differences. Sometimes the candidates don't know how to articulate that. I lost 2 hours of my life at a city council meet the candidates meeting where literally I could not tell who the Republicans and the Democrats were saying exactly the same thing. And sure. I was like, really? I don't know. Even if I voted, what would I do? Like, this is crazy. I disagree with them all. They all have really ideas that like don't make any sense to me. And they're all saying the same thing. Almost, I kid you not, saying the same thing. But that aside, right, like there are differences. I'm not of the mindset of like, oh, you know, they're all the same. But I think we have to be paying attention to what is the outcome that we're seeking, and is this the means by which we're going to get that outcome? You know, it does something. It does many things, some of which are negative and positive. And if we think that voting is going to do X, Y, Z, and actually it's doing A, B, C, then I think you have to think through whether or not you want to keep doing it. Is there another means by which X, Y, Z could be more attainable? Is there somewhere else I could send my money than to somebody's campaign
yes.
that would make XYZ more attainable?
Yeah.
Is there some other line that I could be on instead of waiting at the voting booth that would help make XYZ more possible? Again, I think what I want to do is to inspire people, hopefully, to be asking themselves those questions. You know, people might not come to the same conclusion that I have, but the idolatry is, I think, in the not asking and the assumption that this is like some kind of sacred rite that I have to participate in for whatever reason.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's good. Well, Nikisha, this has been so good and so informative. I'm thankful for your voice and for you taking the time to come and talk.
Sure. Thank you again for the invitation. It's been a while since I've spoken about this topic, so I'm glad to revisit it and to feel re-energized too by the conversation. But yeah, again, Electing Not to Vote is a book that came out several years ago. Like I said, I have an essay in there that delves a little bit more into some of the historical points that I was making. There is a book called The Consequences of Consent, which I refer to pretty heavily in my essay, that does some more detailed kind of tracking about kind of groups getting the right to vote and then the kind of fervor and activism declining along, you know, after that kind of time. It's very fascinating. So I'd recommend people look at that too. It's by Benjamin Ginsberg, I believe his name is. And Jock Ellul, also a Christian and an anarchist, who wrote fairly extensively. And there are also some Black anarchists too that I would point people to. I cannot pronounce his last name, but Lorenzo, is his first name. KOMBOA, I believe is how to spell his last name. I haven't read a lot of his stuff. But, you know, there would be people within the Black tradition in this country who are anarchists. It's not an only white man thing with ski masks. to read some of what communities of color have said about this too, because this position is not only a white position, and it's not like all Black people vote or think you should vote, or all immigrants vote and think you should vote. There is diversity within these communities, and it pays to be listening to all of those voices as well.
So I'm so glad you said that, because I was going to say, I'm going to put links up on the show notes to all the books that you mentioned, all those authors you just mentioned, and JesusRadicals.com as well, all of that. So if you're listening, you're, you know, driving your car at the gym, you don't have to write this down. I'll have all of this information in the show notes, so be sure to check that out. So, Nikisha, thanks again.
Thank you, Shane. I appreciate it.
Thanks for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Remember, you can find all the show notes for this show and all shows at shaneblackshear.com. Oh, and hey, have you ever thought about starting your very own podcast? I bet you have. And I think you should do it. In fact, I've created a course just for you to teach you everything that I've learned over the last couple of years producing Seminary Dropout. So if you're interested in podcasting and want to learn how, go check out my course. You can go there by typing in podcastingforeveryone.org. And you can get a special discount by typing in the discount code Seminary Dropout, all one word. That'll give you 25% off. So go check it out. If you have any questions, let me know. Okay. Thanks to those that left ratings and reviews on iTunes this week. Remember, that keeps the show front and center. Also, remember, you can find me on Twitter at @beardonabike. That's @beardonabike. Also, I'm on Facebook, facebook.com/ShaneBlackshear123. And remember that Seminary Dropout is listener supported. You can visit supportseminarydropout.com and press Become a Patron. Remember, this music you're listening to right now is by D.L. Rossi. You can find him online on iTunes and at dlrossi.com. All right, thanks again for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Stay tuned for next week's episode. Love you. Take care. Yeah,